welcome back, ladies and gents, boys and girls. Red Ice Radio is what you are listening to. My name is Henrik Palmgren. I'm from Sweden. It's great to be able to speak with you again. I hope you're doing well and that life is going as it should. And of course, if not, that you're doing what you should be doing to change that. Our website is redicequestions.com. News, radio, Radio 314, videos, insight, episodes, and more. Neil Cramer has been with us many times before on the program. He is a British philosopher and esotericist. His work focuses chiefly on spirituality, but also metaphysics, mysticism, freedom, and inner development. Neil also explores the relationship between esoteric spirituality and many of the social and cultural factors that influence our everyday lives. And that latter part is what we are going to be focusing on today. Neil Cramer, welcome back. It's good to talk to you once again. Hope you're doing well today.
I'm doing great, and it's lovely to be back with you. Thank you.
Excellent. Now, I listened to a few of your recent talks, and it was, as it always is, very refreshing to hear about someone who recognizes many of the taboos of our time and the bullshit with diversity, multiculturalism, but also recognizing the importance of our differences. I'm talking about, you know, from race to the soil, the geography that we brought up in, you know, from the point of view of not only a more spiritual perspective, but just the hands-on things of the things that we experience in life and the things we see and, you know, who we are, basically. I'm just so fed up with the enforcement of the morality of our times, and usually then this comes in a package where it actually is being used against us in every instance, and I think a lot of people are kind of missing that. So I thought it would be really good to bring you back, Neil, and talk about our differences a bit, both when it comes to, you know, sex and race, our tribal identity and culture and how we are tied to the land, but also the striving for, you know, this kind of pathological equality in every aspect as it goes. But it was a while ago since we had you on the program, so I wanted to just kind of ask you, when did you open your eyes to some of these issues, and when did you kind of begin to recognize that, wait a minute, these are aspects that actually are being used against us, and I'd say specifically in the West, we've seen this enforcement being, you know, wheeled out the longest. So I think we have the most difficulty with actually recognizing some of these issues. What do you think, Neil?
Yeah, I think to answer your question, it started for me to my awareness of this tool of culture and race and ethnicity and sexuality and all these seemingly natural things, you know, our different races, our different cultures, the way we express ourselves emotionally and sexually, things that appear natural on the outside. In the 1990s in Britain, there was this enormous shift in how things were dealt with, to do with particularly race, and to do with prohibitions and prescripted language and stuff. And I noticed that on the television, so watching things on you know, BBC Two and Channel Four and these particular kinds of programs, it seemed to be very heavily biased. So that got me thinking about the relationship between culture and what I call empire, which I'll come to describe what I think that is in a minute, because I think that leads us to a clear view of race as well. So the relationship between culture, empire, and race is kind of important. And I would say that the mainstream culture that we have in the West, of course, in particular, which represents the dominant global paradigm right now, the culture that we see through our screens and through Apple and Google and Facebook and pop music and blockbuster movies and jobs and factories and offices, all of that culture is imperial culture, and it has very little to do with the native reflection of real human beings to me. And I would say that it's not arisen organically from men and women of the land. It's not the result of their natural creativity and visions and impulses. And the majority of that conventional culture that we see before us, particularly today on our computers and whatnot, and of course going back a little more on televisions and newspapers, is wholly of empire. And it's very carefully engineered to fabricate a dependence on technology and a relinquishment of personal freedom and social control. So a nice benchmark for this for me is to think that real human cultures are slow to develop, gradual, strong, you know, they're rooted in a spiritually resonant morality, a and a great relationship with the land, without exception.
Mm, yeah.
Whereas imperial cultures are the opposite. They're fast and weak and despiritualized. Things like thug culture, or porn culture, or sport culture, or gender or sexuality biased culture. They have no root to me, and I've never felt they did do, and I still don't 20 years later. And I propose to you and your audience that they do not arise from the human heart at all, that they are imperial cultures essentially conditioning people to parrot messages, you know?
Yep.
So I've said empire and imperial. Let me just clarify what I mean by empire. I keep using this word. Let me explain. People who are familiar with me and my work may know. Many listeners won't. So let me just take a minute to say that, because I think it's pivotal to what we're talking about today. When I first started looking at all this in the end of the 90s, we called it the system, you know. And then later, when alternative researchers began to kind of map out some of the fraternal and secret organizations involved in the system, it was then called the Illuminati. And then at the end of the 90s and the early 2000s, we called it the Matrix after that wonderful movie. Yeah. And as time passed, we began to understand, you know, there was also a sort of blatant globalism and geopolitical agenda. And that forced people to think of another word, and we started to call it the New World Order. And there's all sorts of other more arcane things, like the Brotherhood of the Black Shadow and Masonic Sorcerers and all sorts of things like that, the Council of the Demons and more romantic titles like that. And I myself used the term the control system for a long time, which served me very well. And I was one of the people who kind of seeded that meme a decade or so ago. And it helped, I think, because it neutralizes some of that romance for the other more elaborate titles, which can be unhelpful for, you know, newcomers. And that manipulated view of reality that the system put forth, I called the construct. And in my book, I called it the distortion, because it's kind of a distortion of reality. So all these different titles, you know, swishing around. And in my life, as I continue to refine my spiritual development to the best of my abilities in my own self and in those who choose to work with me and collaborate with me, when I looked at the system closely and saw an even better way of describing it, I felt that it was very clearly equated with empire. And of course, if we trace the lineage of this thing, we see that there is a line connecting Persia and Egypt and Rome and Britain and America. And we get the picture, those of us who have done this research, that it is indeed, it's one empire. An empire geographically just being a group of regions or countries ruled over by a central authority, traditionally a monarch, but today more frequently like an oligarchy. So empire is a good term. I think it works, and it shifts the meaning a little bit, and I shift the meaning. So I say in my language that empire is an ethos. Not a group of people necessarily, but an ethos that seeks to control humankind by restricting it to a lower state of being, to a immature state of mental, physical, cultural, and spiritual development. And that's what empire is to me. It's very old by modern standards of history. It's ancient. And it is super influential and super effective. And it works well in what it aims to achieve. It's mm-hmm. very clever.
Yeah.
And what it aims to achieve for me, and I think it's important to remind ourselves of this, is a very simple thing, really, which is to keep a large number of people in ignorance and unmindful reproduction. Ignorant people in pain, procreating, spawning more ignorant people in pain.
Yeah.
Which is what I think empire seeks to do above all else, and it does it very well.
Mm-hmm.
It's also important to note that empire is apolitical, very apolitical, nothing to do with it, politics of either colour. It's totally immoral, and it is collectivist in its disposition. So it always places group goals over individual goals. It has, as I say, zero political polarization. So all thoughts, however well intended, of democratic or labor or republican or neocon or libertarian thinking, any of that, every flavor of this politics is owned by empire. And they're all really just kind of sterile puppet shows, a bit of theatre for the sake of appearances, and have nothing to do with power at all. Same thing for Judaism and Christianity and Islamic, all pieces of empire. And every major world power and sovereign state must accept this rule of empire or risk isolation or war, worst case, war, invasion.
Like we've seen.
As we've seen,
yeah.
And we can list some countries and look at that in detail a bit later. The really interesting bit of this, though, because that seems like quite an opponent, doesn't it? But the really interesting bit, which gives us a lovely, genuine chunk of optimism and authority in ourselves, is that despite all of this initially overwhelming power of the system, empire absolutely requires our implicit consent to function. It physically cannot act against us unless we agree to it. And why? Why, people may ask, how can you say that? And I've described this before, and I would say this. The intelligences that constitute empire are playing a very high-level game, notwithstanding the negativity of it and the horror of it. It is not a low-consciousness thing that they're doing. So the higher the orchestrating consciousness of anything, anywhere, the more it has to abide by a universal law, a kind of celestial physics that prevents total fragmentation in a galaxy. And it works very well. And one of these laws prohibits breaching the consent of any sovereign being. So the empire must give notice of its actions before it acts. And like in regular law here, it gives two kinds. Constructive notice, like a document pinned to the town hall notice board that says, we're going to make some change in the community, we're going to build a new freeway. And if the people do nothing, notice has been given, and their silence is construed as consent,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep.
So that's one thing that empire does. The other type of notice is actual notice, like when a man divorces his wife, a husband divorces his wife, and somebody serves her with the papers hand to hand. That is actual notice. So empire gives notice, has to give notice, of its skullduggery and naughtiness. In law, in media, in education, in culture, all the time it's giving notice. And people, most people, eat it up. Not you and me and our strong, independent listeners here. They're a little bit different, but most straight, mainstream people who choose not to develop their consciousness or spirit or freedom just nod in agreement to the notices and stay silent and do nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one of the tricks that empire uses, and this is where it starts to take us into the race and the diversity questions. One of the tricks it uses is it has to harvest that consent somehow, and it has various means of doing that. One of them is for us to claim that we are our name, which is not our name, which is it's a trading entity for empire. Another one is to claim that you live at a particular government-owned property, which we call our street address, which actually is an imperial trading post, you might say. So agreeing to the driving license rules of empire, agreeing to permits and warrants and things like that, agreeing to citizenship of the Imperium, of England or America or Sweden or Canada or wherever, participating in the furtherance of empire through the act of voting. You know, these are just some of the ways in which empire deceives people into agreeing to their way of administrating society. Now, most of us, and I have to say this, including myself, have become involved in these agreements little by little over the years without fully knowing quite what it meant
yeah.
and what we were letting ourselves in for. And if you don't do some of these things, these agreements, you can get into all sorts of trouble. So you have to weigh the advantages and risks and skill sets for yourself personally as to what agreements you're prepared to make and what you're going to withdraw. And as you know, some of the guests on your show and some of my colleagues and friends, some brave pioneers out there think nothing of spending time in jail to prove their point. And they are right. Others serve the cause of freedom and education and enlightenment in other ways by sharing wisdom in more sort of regular ways of life. And therefore, they choose to make some compromises by agreeing to some imperial contracts and getting on with their alternative work in other ways. And it's my view that you have to be very careful in examining what it is that you're doing in life as to, and how you best serve your own growth and your own education and communities before you start doing loads of, you know, unlawful things or whatever. So you tend to find that the best educators in this so-called sovereign law carefully vet and gauge who they work with to properly determine what the motivations are and whether or not the whole business is being conducted in honour or not. So, you know, it's a very interesting thing how that agreement is obtained. And it's partially because of that that I often say that empire's great power really is not in its sort of sheer force and resources, but it's in its invisibility, in its concealment. So most people just don't realize that they have been consciously and spiritually confined. They just don't know. And they don't want to think about it. You know, they don't want to think about some weird, wicked conspiracy that's messing up the whole planet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's two points to that, which I think particularly for newcomers or perhaps some of the younger listeners who are literally just getting into this, that we have simple ignorance, which is when someone just doesn't know something. Like, I don't know how to speak Chinese. I don't have that data or technique. So that's simple ignorance. There's another form of ignorance, complex ignorance, where there is an intentional preservation of ignorance. So people say, look, I just don't want to know about the New World Order. I don't like talking about that weird stuff. I'm happy with my life the way it is. Leave me alone, don't upset things. And this sort of portcullis comes down, and that's the end of their growth. And there's nothing new going to come in. So that's complex ignorance. People bring down that portcullis, you know, like on a castle.
Yeah.
And you have to leave them to it. And what we're concentrating on is not those people. That's their business. We're concentrating on ourselves and our friends and colleagues who choose self-awareness and freedom and spiritual growth, because it changes people. And that's what's very scary to a lot of uninformed, normal folk. So I'll say this in my summation of empire, because I know we've got a lot of interesting things to get to. Empire is what happens when human beings forget who they are and what they're doing. And I think it's a very important point to consider that some of that is our fault. Some of it isn't. Some of it is. We further and support empire by our stupidity. So we have to seize that bit, reverse it by being excellent and wise, and that helps to dissolve the system. There is that other element, though, where empire is not all our fault. There are other entities that lie outside the realm of normal perceptions, both physically and philosophically, who are involved. And let's simplify that for a minute, because always when we talk about this system, who's at the top of it, who runs it, who originated it? Let's simplify it by saying this. Some life forms in the world use a strategy of getting ignorant people in pain to reproduce as the basis for a fuel source, right?
Mm-hmm.
A food source. And the frequency of consciousness that emanates out of those poor bastard human beings who are being exploited is used to power and sustain a group of entities that cannot survive by their own soul essence, because they're not like us, they're different. As to who they are and where they're from, I would suggest to you, very honestly and frankly, that no one on this planet is really sure about that. Though we have detected their presence, and they are mentioned in many of our old sacred writings and mystical texts that have been, you know, unsequestered. And we have many names for these entities. We used to call them demons, you know, simple as that. Then they were called black wings in Europe, and flyers in South America, and archons, inorganic beings, and some very wise men that I know call them holes, H-O-L-E-S, because they resemble little mini black holes when they manifest here in this world in the 3D. And soon they'll be called something else. But they are life forms out there somewhere, swishing around, needing to sustain themselves, needing to eat and live. The difference is, as far as we can determine, they don't have a soul. So they can't go back to the divine source like me and you can, because they didn't originally emanate from it. So they're knackered. They're up shit creek. And so they're doing all kinds of bizarre and desperate things to try and sustain themselves using an outside power source. And for a little while, a few millennia, which is nothing, they've been messing around on this planet. And I would say it is a very limited operation. It doesn't go on for much longer. But it does provide, and again, this is the flip side to that, it does provide a very unique opportunity for sort of specialized, ultra-tactical spiritual development on this planet. And whoever comes here, voluntarily, always, knowing the full deal beforehand, is doing two marvelous things, right? Number one, you're getting the best spiritual training anywhere in the galaxy here. Number two, you are helping to speed up the dissolution of empire. Whoever comes here and chooses growth and consciousness speeds up the end of empire. And all we have to do that is recalibrate that conscious fuel source to a different frequency, which once we get to a critical mass, which I believe we've already crossed and reached, and we're now witnessing a sort of end game, those guys are off and we get to do things right here. Once they're gone, their minions are disempowered and natural human culture can arise again as it once did. Takes a while, but we get there in the end. And if anybody finds that a little bit of a stretch, this business of a sort of compressed consciousness through pain as a fuel source, I totally get that. But consider this, right? Just imagine a few hundred years ago, if someone had said that you can power a whole village by sunlight. Imagine suggesting to people in the 16th century, they'd wonder how the hell that could possibly happen. There's nothing tangible. There's nothing there. Is it
right.
Some magic?
Yep.
You know, there's no coal or oil or wood or metal or gears. No, you can do it with this invisible, weightless, these photons that float through the air. We call that light. It's a piece of the energetic spectrum that can be utilized as a power source. And there's another one, which currently we call low consciousness. So that's the game of empire to me. And whatever, we do have the ability to change that. We do.
Yeah, let me add something there. I guess there's 2 points for those who are reluctant to kind of get into that mindset. One way of just looking at it is basically before we, you know, developed the microscope, we had a hard time proving that things like bacteria existed, for example. Well, we might be able to prove it, but we couldn't see it flat out, right? It has to do with some of the tools that it takes to recognize something there. And I think that even if we look at planet Earth, for example, there are numbers of life forms in the most strangest of places on this planet that finds a way of feeding off of some kind of energy source. And wherever there's something, maybe not left over, but wherever there is abundance of something, something is going to attach itself to that. I'm not so foreign to this idea, obviously, but for those who are, I think there is a reason to that madness to a certain extent of just looking at what already is going on here and if that's plausible or not, you know?
I agree. And I think that even if you go to your sort of classical Hindu spiritual philosophy, they have a word for this fuel source, which is dukkha, D-U-K-K-H-A, which some people translate as suffering, but it actually, a better word for it is unsatisfactoriness. So, as the Buddha said, life is suffering. What he's saying is life is unsatisfactory. And that's one of the characteristics, one of the three marks of existence of this planet, according to this ancient, you know, Indian sage, that dukkha exists in abundance on Earth, this unsatisfactoriness, a kind of pain, an inner pain. And I believe that dukkha is that fuel source, which is compressed consciousness. And if you squash that down, it becomes what we would call tension or anxiety or bitterness or resent. And that frame of mind is fuel. And so when I say to people, the most powerful thing you can do is make yourself excellent and balanced and cheerful, you stop becoming a fuel source then, and you have an influence on everyone around you who says, you know, Henrik's a good guy. He's always smiling and laughing. He's clever. He's a nice, warm human being, balanced. That is powerful, not in your knowledge, that's secondary, but in your actual being. Because once you detach from becoming a fuel source, it affects not only you and your quality of life and those nearest and dearest, but also all the people you liaise and interact with, your colleagues and so on. And that has an amazing effect because it's very inspirational, and I have people in my life who inspire me in that way, and sometimes I might inspire other people. So it is super important to remember that, I mean, we'll come on to talking about race and so on in a second, but despite all the mechanics of it, it is a spiritual adventure, this. It is a spiritual game, and that the answers are spiritual. They're not political. You know, that's just going around on the hamster wheel.
Now, tell us a little bit more about the connection between this and, I guess, who we are, right? Because all of this has to do with how we've become, I'd say, deracinated, if that's a word, deracinated, being uprooted, right? We're being drawn out from something. We've had a way of life for many, many thousands of years all over this world, and which I see as beautiful. Sure, there was struggle, there was violence, there was intense battles between different peoples and whatnot. At the same time, I do have a kind of a romantic view about it, as in comparison to how we find ourselves, you know, today with everything. And I look back on, you know, some of my own cultures and to a certain extent wish that we had the capability of being more like they were as opposed to more like who we are today. And I feel that we've lost that. I think it has to do with the importance of culture and tradition and understanding who we are. And this is something that is completely foreign almost to us in the West today, right?
Yeah, I completely understand. And I think that many intelligent, sensitive men and women have a slightly romantic view of that, which I think is nothing wrong with that. For me, race and sexuality and diversity and all that has been massively confused by a very concerted effort to install into many, many human minds a sort of self-censoring thought pattern that I know you've dealt with before, which we call political correctness. And I'm not going to go over the origins of that because a lot of interesting and talented researchers have already done that. And I do outline it in my podcast, which I call a Rome cast because I'm roaming around, podcast number 12 briefly. But it's been in the works for about 70 years, political correctness, and it was mainly propagated from the 70s onwards, and it was born in the 30s, really. In England, as I said at the top of the show, it really got traction in the 1990s that you could see, which was the first time I encountered people who were starting to self-censor in England. Self-censor their thoughts and feelings against a measurement that the government had put forth in terms of what is acceptable and what isn't. Political correctness, to me, it has two aspects. It's there to silence dissent and coerce consent, right? So that is to stop people expressing their feelings about others and the way they choose to live, and to compel people to adopt a new way of thinking about each other, what's okay and what's not okay. So in the 90s in Britain, you had to stop saying certain words like packy or blacky or chink or jap or puff or queer or spastic or cripple, anything like that, which people have said for a long time, was stopped, right?
Yep.
And you might think, well, they're offensive. Of course, I understand that. And I myself would perhaps not choose to go around using those words unmindfully because I'm a nice guy. I'm a considerate man. And I don't like, not really interested in anyone's sexuality or race anyway, per se. But the point here is that words became prohibited. I'll say that again. A sequence of sounds from our mouths or inscriptions on a page in ink in the English language became prohibited in Britain in the 1990s. And today, using some of those words can get you professionally ruined or even jailed.
Mm-hmm.
Incitement to racial hatred being the current favourite law in England. And there's a funny observation here as well, just to lighten it up a bit, because millions and millions of grandparents, people in the 70s and 80s and 90s, chose not to adopt this new language rule set. And so we had a very comical situation which still exists in Britain where millions of old people go around saying these crazy things that young people can't believe. And one man that I knew, who was not a family member but was a lovely old man I was visiting in hospital, this old guy in his 80s, was in hospital in a bed awaiting surgery, and he quietly whispered to me about the doctor. He said, is he a blackie, the doctor? And I said, yeah, he is, yeah. And the old guy said, you know, does he know what he's doing? And I said, of course he knows what he's doing. You know, he's a spinal surgeon. He's very highly recommended and super talented. And he's a lovely guy as well. Mm. And this old guy said, well, that's okay then. You know, why does he talk like that, this old man? Because when this old man was a boy in England, there were no black people. There were none.
Yep.
And so it wasn't until he was an adult that he first saw anyone who wasn't white. And so black and Asian people were considered in Britain when he was a young man, newcomers, visitors at first. And this old man naturally wondered if these newcomers were accustomed to the ways of England and the English and the English, you know, methods and morality and ways of doing things. You know, the most natural thing in the world, quite innocent. And however ignorant that might seem to some people today, it's blameless, right? But still, when I hear this story retold sometimes in family circles, it's told in whispers, you see, because people have become conditioned yeah. that certain things are not allowed. And I'll tell you, hundreds of good, moral, open-minded, solid people who I have known in my life would be arrested if they use their freely spoken, truly expressed language in the wrong place. You know, they're not racist. They're not bigoted or prejudiced. But they do have preferences that have been disregarded, and they're tired of it. So I think in terms of what you were talking about, to get to the heart of it, for a minute, let's substitute the word race for the word tribe, for a minute, because I think that can be helpful. Tribal identity is the initial platform for spiritual identity. The tribal heritage of a people lays down the pattern for a particular kind of refined self-expression, morality, and spiritual development. And it is crucial for people to understand their tribal heritage. If I were an imperial controller and I wanted to suppress the evolution of humans for a few more centuries, one really effective way of doing that would be to have all the tribes, all the tribal identities obliterated by a very disrespectful amalgamation so that no platform for spiritual growth would exist. Identity would be lost and inner development would be enormously impeded. And that's what this game is. To point the finger at any of the tribes is deeply ignorant, right? We must not do that. I have no time for people who behave like that. We have to first see the truth of tribal differences and then realize that dim-witted tribal people from any creed, all creeds, have been hopelessly conditioned into falsehood. And there's nothing we can do to change that except wait for them to die off, right? But those who are not intelligent enough to think for themselves have consumed this imperial racial deception and either become separatist and nationalistic, which is not very good, or egalitarian, thinking that we're all the same and have equal opportunity to everything, which is also mightily brainless. And either way, empire doesn't care. It's a win-win for them. So we have to educate ourselves, first and foremost, and those free-thinking friends and family who are open to it, and the young people, right? Very important. And for me, the truth of tribal identity rests in a very simple premise, which is that we are different, right? We are different from one another. Wherever you come from, what your bones are like, and your skin, and your mind, and your heritage, and your genetics, and your spirit, all of these things come together to make you different, uneven, unequal, dissimilar, right? Not the same. And in some tribes of men and women in the modern world, in some of those tribes, self-awareness is low, and IQ is low, and spiritual development is low, and communication is very rudimentary. And if that's the case, those things have an impact on that individual's ability to perceive and comprehend reality. And some people would say, well, those are by no means the only measure of gauging the development of a human, and I'd agree with that. But for me, and my Western European human cultural heritage, self-awareness, IQ, spiritual development, and communication skills are central to my way of interacting with reality, and they are, therefore, the methods and skills that I most value and appreciate for me, and perhaps some people a bit like me. This does not mean that people who live in different ways with none of those faculties are doing something wrong or less valuable. That's not for me to decide. But if those people come into my realm and claim to have the same faculties, which they do not, then there's an obvious disparity. And this, to me, points to the heart of it, how to view this properly and equitably and intelligently, because we do have to tread wisely here, because a lot of stupid people get polarized if we don't. There are all sorts of people listening to this show, as you know, from all different cultures and races and whatever, and we all look different. And in my own family, we have English, Scottish, Welsh, Oriental, Jewish, African, all sorts of things, right? So I've got my own skin in this game, if you pardon the pun, in terms of diversity, you know, you betcha. However, the fact remains that we are not the same tribally. Some people, some tribes are brilliant, and some people are crap. Some cultures are outstanding, and some are bloody awful, right? Some cities are beautiful and functional, and some cities are ugly and dysfunctional. And to me, whether you're looking at the individual or a group, all of these things are totally decided on merit by the skills and talents and intelligence and wisdom of the people. And some of those are close to empire and some are far from it. Some, you know, kind of have empire in check a little bit and are very clever how they do it. And others are totally ruled by empire and have lost the game altogether. But nevertheless, right, without exception, people always have the power to make free will choices to reflect and transpose their own unique mentality and emotions and creativity and visions of excellence into the world. That's what diversity is, our uniqueness. We are singular. So let's take one tribal homeland, Germany. Right, I love Germany. My favorite painter is German. My favorite philosopher is German. My favorite composer is German. My favorite mountain, the Zugspitze, is in Germany. Right?
Nazi.
I must be.
You must be, right? Yeah.
I must be. You should see the giant swastika behind me.
There we go. Well, it's an ancient, beautiful, traditional symbol.
It's a beautiful, ancient symbol that goes back about 5,000 years.
Yeah.
Germany has achieved an extraordinary refinement of art, music, literature, mysticism, culture, and thought, which form an incredible foundation for spiritual evolution in individuals. And Germany's achievements go on and on. I'm not going to list them. It is a fabulous place. It is affected by empire, yes. And it's currently having some problems, yes. But over the last 2,000 years, it represents, to me, one of the highest achievements of human culture anywhere. And to compare Germany to almost any other country, particularly outside Europe, they pale into significance really fast in those previously mentioned forms of human expression in particular. And I do not ignore these things when I analyze the heritage of a peoples, whether they're English or Mexican or French or Swedish or Israeli, Nigerian, whatever. I look at what has arisen over the last few thousand years in their homeland. And the tribal peoples are deeply connected to their land. And the land makes us function and live and look different ways. And we have this gift of life and of connection with our land. And if people choose to waste that gift, then they face the consequences in their lives and their countries. They made it that way. And if people choose to accept and cultivate their gift with vigor and gratitude, then they become master of their reality and afford themselves greater refinement and well-being and potency and higher achievement. And that is ours to decide, you know. That's our wit and wisdom, our being and all that. And ethnicity and sexuality and equality just don't come into it at all. Do whatever you please in honor and peace. Go wherever you wish with integrity and power alone, just us. You know, that's how it works. So I think in thinking about this, it draws to mind my sort of mystical cosmogony, you know, the beginning of something. And I would say it like this, and I'm kind of almost quoting here from something that I wrote the other day, but I think it's relevant to what we're talking about. In ancient days, there were five great tribes on Earth. A black tribe, a brown tribe, a yellow tribe, a red tribe, and a white tribe. and each arose from the soil of their native continent and were uniquely calibrated in body and mind to resonate with their particular land. And as well as the physical landscape, each tribe was born attuned to the particular energies, the finer energies of their area, their region, its heritage, its sacred teachings, you know. And whilst everybody's totally free to move around anywhere and connect with any other tribes, there is always a very special correspondence with each tribe that keeps them enmeshed and resonating with their homeland, their heritage. And they were in their true power when they were in harmonious concert with their indigenous atmosphere, physically and spiritually, metaphysically. And this atmosphere also encompassed the other animals of their realm and the organic cultures and customs of men and women and the songs and technologies and visions of their sages, right? And each tribe was totally different from one another. They looked different, they smelled different, they walked different, they talked different. All completely distinct, very contrasting, and as I said in this piece, as a wolf cannot be compared to a salmon, right? They're not parallel, other than they exist here at the same time.
Yeah.
And it is said that the black tribe is the oldest, they were here first, then the brown tribe arrived from another star, and then the yellow, and then the red, and the white, all from different places, different stars. Each tribe came from a different star, and some people feel that the earth belongs to the oldest tribe, and some don't. And the wisest amongst all tribes know that it belongs to no one. It is combined specialist tribal knowledge from all of them that come together. That's where you get a better picture. And this is what really ushers in a new transcendence, a new evolution that moves us beyond tribal identification, beyond tribe, beyond human. But for now, it's necessary. Tribal identity is the platform for spiritual identity. The greatest danger to the ascendant path of humanity is to have the tribes believe that they're the same, to have their singular skills and insights just leveled. So I would say that today, for the present times, this is a tribal planet, and we have to acknowledge that as the basis for our excellence, and to think otherwise, to forget our glories and our roots and our path, is to contribute to the imperial strategy, which is to get one race of grey men, which we don't want that.
No,
we are different.
No. Well, you know, words, as you detailed elsewhere as well, they change meaning over time. And just the very idea of a nation, even if you look at the Bible, talks about this as being more of a tribal identity. It's an old French word, nation, if I even pronounce that correct, which basically means that which has been born. It's something that is coming out of something. In other words, it's the soul of a people. And therefore, when people think of nationalism, for example, today, they think of the geographical boundaries and the legal structure of what exists in a country today. And that is not what it is. A nation is the people, you know. So there are these huge misconceptions even on the etymological level today of when people talk about these things, you know.
Yeah, there are, and I think that's important to consider, that tribalism doesn't mean like people fighting each other in little disconnected groups.
Exactly, yeah.
It means that each piece of land gives rise to a particular soul resonance, you might say. So if the soul was like sunlight beaming down onto different parts of the earth, which in esoteric terms it's very much like that, soul comes into us, like consciousness comes into us. Depending on where it is and what's going on and the nature of the geography and composition of the land and its heritage and the blood in the people gives a very different expression of that soul. So to try and equalize them and normalize them is a disaster, because it takes away the very thing that we're being asked to do, which is that each soul group, which is very equitably reflected in the different tribes, has a particular talent, and each one can do different things that the other ones cannot do.
Well, exactly, and I think let's touch upon a couple of points here. They obviously have managed to have us believe that giving this up, and I'll say race instead of tribe, those who have given up a racial identity, that this is the greatest of virtues in our times, and that this somehow is going to, you know, solve the predicaments of all the issues that we're facing currently. And we can, of course, see this when the empire is forcing us all together, in some cases even violently so. What would the empire gain from eroding tribal, or let's say then racial awareness and identity, do you think, Neil?
For a very, very small number of people who make spiritual development the whole axis and fulcrum of their life, racial identity is irrelevant. It doesn't really matter. And I know people where it's totally irrelevant, and it's largely irrelevant to me. However, for the vast majority of people here who are beginning their spiritual adventure, whether it's in one life or over thousands of lives, your tribal identity is the cradle of your spiritual development. And without it, you are in trouble. And even for me, where I don't necessarily place enormous value personally, just for me, on my tribal identity, my racial heritage, it's very close to my heart. And the land of England is the most beautiful place in the whole universe to me. There's nothing like it.
Yeah.
And some of the English people and the English customs and where they came from through the Nordic lands and the Germanic lands is very exciting and very beautiful to me. And nothing touches that. That's a personal thing, but nothing touches that for me. It's right up there. I know, with respect to my brothers and sisters out there who are beginning their journeys, that that cradle of racial heritage is super nourishing and important. And I will do everything I can to maintain and preserve that, because it has tremendous value and potency. It's very difficult for empire to sequester that. So the most they can do is to let us disregard that cradle of heritage, of tribal identity, and think it's something racist. So it's a real kind of Orwellian, you know, doublespeak mind swap thing,
yeah,
where they just take it out of the language so people cannot express it. Whereas in every single mystical order that I have ever studied under or with or through or of, however you want to put it, whether directly or indirectly, there's a great emphasis on racial identity, tribal identity, a great emphasis to say, in the resonance of the souls is the wisdom, and in the resonance of the souls is the method, not just the data, but the actual application, the technique, the being of soul. And if you take that away, you're on your own, and you're just playing roulette, and who knows what will happen. So it has to be honored and preserved, because it has great value. And if you only need to look at somebody who has had great influence on our modern media still, many years after his death, Conan Doyle, to see that his own particular love for his country was embedded in many of his works, as was his other fellow countryman, Tolkien, who said, you know, Scandinavian folklore, without that, I just put some pictures up the other day on Facebook or whatever, but without Scandinavian folklore, there would be no Middle Earth. Nothing
that's
at
right.
all.
Yep, that's
it's
right.
It's all completely developments and side shoots from that. And it's one of the most precious mystical backdrops we have in modern fiction, that, to me.
Yeah.
And I think it's critical that that's maintained. And Tolkien was a very fierce opponent of industrialization. And he said, industrialization isn't just about repetition and money and economy, it destroys spiritual heritage.
Yeah, yeah.
And so if he was around today, it'd be on your show next week talking to you. You know, it'd be another guest saying exactly what we're saying.
Well, exactly. I believe you're right there. And I mean, I feel that there is a deeper connection to, you know, genetics as well, and the very fact that you are carrying on that from your ancestors. I think there's something to that. I view it as a spiritual thing, bar none. I mean, the prospect or imagining that, you know, what I know as distinct Scandinavian people, for example, would be gone is horror to me. I can't imagine something which is would be more painful to me. And to protect and preserve that, as all things we have basically today in our moral viewpoints, we are, you know, conservationists. We want to preserve, we want to protect environments, and we want to protect you know, different, various different animal species, and that's awesome, and we should. And I think we should have the same view about ourselves as well, as we're just completely steamrolled over by modernity. And in most cases, just as you, to harken back to what you said before, most people don't even reflect on it because it's not part of their consciousness. It's not something that they think about. They don't, they haven't put that in perspective. It feels to me they haven't maybe awakened that deeper connection to themselves and to those who've come before them, that have carried them into the world and have made their existence even a reality, you know?
I know, I couldn't agree more. And I'll tell you one very simple way that you can correct that is by introducing wise elders into every child's life. In every community, when you have a wise elder, they show you the importance of what came before, whether 100 years or 10,000 years. And that has been an enormous revelation in my life, to know the wisdom of the elders, those who are still with us, as I say, and those who have passed by. They carry that spiritual adventure, that spiritual chronology in their blood. And when they pass their blood to us, they pass on their spiritual attainment. It's in the blood, right?
Yeah.
And so some races are very advanced with that, and some are not. And just as we wouldn't look upon a baby who doesn't know how to do, you know, quantum physics, you wouldn't think, you stupid bastard. You just think, well, they're a baby, they don't know, so we have to uphold and nurture and support them. As we should be doing with races who don't know that yet, because they're new, they've not been here very long, or because they come from a different place. You know, we are here together, there is a reason for that, but to cling to our equality is very damaging, because we don't need any of that stuff, right? Because all moral men and women know that the success and happiness in life is by treading lightly and by having compassion and having wholeness in everything we do. And that, we don't need equality for that. Everybody's here breathing. That's the only right we have. There are no other rights from that. What we do have, though, is the gift that's been given to us in our blood, which is a link back to the soul heritage of the people who did the same thing as we did for millions of years.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, just imagine as well, I mean, look at a map. Let's take Europe. Both you and me are Europeans. That's, you know, our interest to talk about that as well on top of things. But Tacitus or Jordanus or any of these historians that have been mapping the various different tribes in Europe, and when you come to the realization of how many already have been immersed into larger and larger entities, and in some cases we've been talking about flat out genocides, like the Kimbri, for example, or the Teutons or something like that. These were completely slaughtered and absorbed into the Roman Empire, for example. And it's horrible to think about that, but to think that we are not, you know, smart enough to stop that at this stage is even, you know, that's unforgivable in my view, you know?
It is, and it makes me think, I mean, it's a very serious thing, but it makes me, when very big, heavy, serious things come, I often see a funny thing straight away, which I think is sometimes healthy. It makes me think of, like, a lot of people who are into spirituality who come to my work, say, you know, how can you talk about tribalism? You know, we're all one. What are you talking about? You know, people speak about oneness, don't they? We're all one, one giant unified blob of celestial yumminess. You know, why worry about differences?
Exactly.
Listen, check this out. I would say that oneness is a state of being that is achieved and attained in direct relation to the amount of work you've done on yourself, right? And I have noticed that people who go on about oneness have done the least amount of work on themselves, and their oneness is rubbish, right? And if your deeds and conduct and mind and heart, and you've spent an enormous amount of effort and seriousness on your own self-evolution, then your oneness is a little bit better, because you're actually resonating within this cradle of life better. So you check that out. When you hear someone going about oneness, I bet they've done a very little amount of work on themselves.
Well, you know, that's really funny you mention that, because, I mean, I've heard other people talk about, for example, when they criticize multiculturalism, et cetera, and they say, you know, I think it was even Mark Stein or something like that, talk about the greatest critique, not that he had of it, but one of the big ones was that everyone who believes in this monoculture or multiculturalism, those are kind of weird enough interchangeable to a certain extent. They're most supposed to mean diversity, right? But at the same time, when you slash everything together, it becomes one, a monoculture.
That's absolutely true. That's very ironic, and it's dead true, yeah.
And so, but you've noticed that a lot of the people don't actually have to have any knowledge about any culture whatsoever, because it's all one, right? You don't have to know, he made a joke about it, but you don't have to know what the prime export of, the Philippines are or whatever. You don't have to know anything about any of the countries, because it's all just the same. It's a kind of it's an easy way out, if you will. No.
It is, and that culture, all you do is you look at what Apple and Google and Samsung and Sony are doing. That's the culture from a lot of people. That is the culture.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and we've heard people talk about it. I mean, we had the astrophysicist Michio Kaku. I mean, he just openly talked about, as kind of a scientist, the mouthpiece of the New World Order, talking about, like, global culture is, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger movies, Madonna records, jeans and T-shirt, a blue jeans and T-shirt. That's it. That's what we have. And that's what that's what we've sucked up, and we've lost our connection to our tribal identity, which is so important, you know?
Yeah, and that's why history has been largely removed from the syllabus in America and Europe, because it's too much of a clue. Because a lot of young people, when they're taught history by a talented, inspirational, engaged teacher, start to get excited, right?
Yeah.
History is very exciting, and it's very comforting and very reassuring, and it provides wisdom. And so you'll see that is slowly disappearing from the syllabus, not because it's not relevant for vocational training, which is all that education really is nowadays, but because it's too much of a clue. Because if you end up going down some of those wonderful pathways that are full of, this incredible sort of evolutionary thought and excitement and adventure, and put the power back in our hands, you start losing the Apple and the Google consumers, don't you? And they think, I don't want to work in an office in Silicon Valley. I want to study the origins of my people and go and look at the megaliths and the hills and the dolmens and all this,
Well, exactly. And I mean, and that's it. That you're encapsulating my awakening to realizing, becoming concerned about the things we're talking about now, looking into the history of, the people in Scandinavia, from the Vikings to Beowulf and other people, the heroes that have walked those lands. Oh. I mean, I see the burial mounds are right there, unexplored. They're unexplored. They're waiting with a mystery behind them. And I'm thinking about this. I'm reading about it. It becomes part of me. And something awakens in me. And that's when this concerned is like a flame enlightened, and it's never going to go out. I just know that.
And that's why you and I and people like us have to keep doing what we're doing, because they say, well, Henrik's a good guy, Kramer's a good guy, and they're very interested in their heritage and the history of their peoples and these warriors and tribes and these so-called mythologies. That makes people take a look. So when you see serious people who are making a life of their chosen practice and chosen study, it does inspire other people. It inspires me when I see somebody who's really excited about something. It makes me take a look. And when I know that it's central to their heart, it makes me interested in it. Enthusiasm's infectious, isn't it? And, the dignity that the knowledge of your own heritage bring, people like that. It's very lacking in the world today, that sort of honor in your own heritage. People like it, and they want it. And when they see people resonating it and expounding on it intelligently without polarizing, it makes people want to take a look. And we all have them. Wherever you are on the planet, we all
exactly.
have them.
Yeah.
I have mine, and I like mine probably better than anyone else's.
And that's how it should be. That's the point, right? That's
exactly.
how it should. You
that's
should
right.
you should be biased against that.
You
want to be one who wants to preserve that more than anybody else want to preserve that. What's so difficult about that, right?
Yeah. It's super easy, and that's why we have to intelligently and bravely tackle these issues without polarization and using language carefully but bravely, because when you get it right, it's so easy and it's so obvious, and it starts to dissolve all that conditioning that we were talking about with all that ugly empire business really fast. So it does require a certain skill to approach it properly, which, you know, thankfully I see pretty well represented these days. It wasn't here till quite recently. It's really taken off in the last few, you know, couple of years or whatever.
Yeah, I would agree with you definitely there. Well, we have much more to talk about. I really just want to carry on our discussion here and get in deeper into some of these issues here. But before we take a break, Neil, please let us know what you want our audience to know, be that about something you have upcoming, your existing work, books, audio tapes, podcasts, what have you. Give us the skinny on what you've got going on right now.
Well, you can go to neilkramer.com and check everything out on there. And the main thing that people focus on is the essays and interviews. And if you like that stuff, of course, then you can download Alchemy of Will, which is like many hours of workshop, many important facets of my education that I share. Unfoldment, Secrets and Sinks, another brilliant workshop that a lot of people took part in and enjoyed, live recordings, my book, The Unfoldment, there's other things on there as well, events in January will start to be listed on that of what I'm doing, working on a really interesting film project, which I can't say anything about, that's very exciting, that'll start to pop up in 2015, working on some interesting teaching engagements next year, over in your neck of the woods on the East Coast, which I'll be telling people more about. So go to neilkramer.com, check that out, have a look at some of the links on there, and I think you might find something you enjoy.
Thank you very much. We'll have the links up on redicecreations.com, neilkramer.com, that's the main website. Go there. All right, we'll take a short break. We'll be right back with more. We're going to pick this up right after the break. I just want to mention a couple of things here because something occurred to me after we spoke with Neil, and I didn't think of mentioning it at the time. That's just kind of how it goes when you do these kinds of shows. There are usually really an array of items that you wish you would have expressed better or commented on in some capacity to help put things, you know, that are said in perspective and in context. But the area that it was concerning was on separatism of different kinds, and it was about white separatism in particular. And, of course, this is my take on it. But we're going to get into and talk more about this in the second hour. We'll speak more about things like the various breakaway movements in, for example, Catalonia, a movement towards independence, also the Scottish independence referendum that took place before this. Well, my take on it is this. I think that independence and breaking away for anyone is a good thing. It's something that I support. I understand it more and more as well. I don't think that other people should step in the way of that. For example, I would support the, you know, Tamil Tigers to break away and form their own society or nation, as it really is, and prevent those 100,000 killed people in those battles over the years in Sri Lanka. I also would support the Tutsi to break away from the Hutu and form their own society as a means to prevent the genocide that we saw. Same with the Bantu or any other group, really, the Tibetans. So why not for the Finns or the Geats? Or the Rugi, the Norwegian people, white people, right? Why not for them? We see a greater and greater move towards centralization, and when we see splinter groups break away, well, then usually we kind of get the Waco scenario. The government, of course, launches a wave of propaganda over people to justify their eventual marching in with the troops, sending in the tanks. And, of course, they say that they're abusing children and all kinds of nastiness that's very difficult to prove. But, you know, if you support separation for any people that desire it, then there can be no double standard about this. If this is what they want to do, why try to step in and prevent that? What is the reason behind that? More than that the bloat of the state want to have more subordinates under it that are funding it and paying into it, of course. I'll take the UK then, for example. We see tremendous attacks on whites in the UK right now. Just a few days ago, we had a rural school in Lincolnshire was denied a top grade by Ofsted inspectors, you know, those who were kind of monitoring the schools, because it was too English and it was not diverse enough. So it was 97% white kids in the school, and because of that, they were denied a top grade. We've heard other things, like, for example, Portland in America is too white. And this is insane. This is forced integration via what the PC crowd now called they call it geospatial discrimination, where you have a scenario where the state is enforcing who can live with whom and where. This is insane. And if you don't support, let's say, white separatism, then why support Tutsi separatism or Ubuntu separatism as a way to preserve the peace? Because, as we know, through Hollywood and what have you, most people conjure up an image of SS troops marching towards Auschwitz, if you talk about white separatism, or that this group is about, you know, seclusion and no peaceful interaction with others. I think that's ridiculous as well, because guess what? White flight is already happening in the UK and America and Sweden too. Whether you like it or not, this is a natural, spontaneous response, really, to what is happening. It's a move by people who basically just want to be with their own and people like them, because this is what feels like home to them. So if multiculturalism is such a wonderful, peaceful thing, then why is this happening? Because whites are so racist? No, think again. So what's wrong with the people wanting to be with their own? I personally support all kinds of separatism. It doesn't bug me. Yeah, I don't care. I don't have a need to force people to live in a certain area with someone. The objection here is that this enforcement, though, is actually happening right now. Take Europe and the rest of the West. We are being pushed out of our own homelands. This is happening now with mass immigration, where people decide to leave, in some cases, their own countries, but in most cases, it's cities or so-called transitional areas because they want a different environment for their kids or for themselves. This is a territorial and demographical war, really, that's being waged on the European people without their consent. And if you have been listening to our previous shows, you know this by now, and you also know who's behind it and what some of the reasons are for this. So anyway, we'll continue to talk more about some of these aspects more in the second hour with Neil Kramer at redicemembers.com. So go there to sign up and tune in as we continue then to talk more about growth, population, but also overpopulation. also the long-term cycle of catastrophe, you know, the rise and fall, both of civilization, but also of, well, what seems like life itself almost on this planet. We discuss preference, selection, and freedom of choice. So don't miss us. This is an interesting discussion here ahead in the next segment that I think you can learn a lot from. It's a somewhat familiar problem to some of you, yet from another viewpoint. We'll talk to you after the break. Thank you for staying with us.